Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, February 14th, 2013, and tonight I have a bunch of details to give, a lot of small topics, each one of them contributing to basically our understanding of the workings of the world here, and really a lot of what unfortunately I have to do is dig through some of these stories, but it's important to understand the amount of effort being put into misinformation. And then I'll also be talking about how comet tails form. It's a topic I started a couple of weeks ago and have to continue that dialogue. So basically, once the comet starts to charge, how does that process work? What are the details? Because it's a very complex process, and so I'm going to go into detail bit by bit, electron by electron, proton by proton, ionized atom by ionized atom. So that will be the main science topic. So at any rate, and I might add that many of these topics have been building up for quite a few weeks here. So they're topics that I meant to cover on previous week's show but didn't have time. Right now, I'll be covering many of these topics, so I'll kind of do a collage of topics here. The Russians recently, that's interesting because I get a lot of feedback from listeners. And this one, once again, somebody wrote in and said the Boy Who Cried Wolf campaign. And this has been going on for a long time. So just kind of a review here in the words of a listener. 2003, Crazy Lady Talks to Aliens, Zeta Bluff. Bluff on the End of the World and Planet X. Okay, so 2007, Comet Holmes Could Be Dangerous, Bluff. Okay, 2010, Comet Elenin Could Be Very Dangerous, Bluff. And then 2012, the Mayan calendar, we're all going to die, bluff. And then it says, oh my goodness, comets are just so boring. I've had enough of this crazy space end of the world rubbish. Then genuine real stories do not get covered. So anyway, that's just an interesting note from a listener. There's another article that just came out from Russians. And remember that back when I was working with the Russians in the mid-90s, they were independent. They had their own space agency. They thought independently. And it was amazing to see the difference in the way they approached science. They actually did real science. It wasn't pre-constructed in the United States with NASA. If they build a space project or a telescope, it's already designated that it's going to be for dark matter or to discover those icy snowballs or whatever it is. It's already pre-designated. They already know what the answer is going to be before they even put the first screw into the spacecraft. But it's what happened. And this happened while I was actually working with the Russians back in the mid-90s. The U.S. came in with money and said, look, we'll give you money. You guys can work with our space scientists, get the good equipment, but you can't talk about this stuff over here, this McCanny stuff, because they were actually teaching my work in the colleges and grad schools. I had an interesting interaction one time. I was at a American Geophysical Union meeting, and I believe that one was in Florida. And so they always have these activities. And the particular activity I'm thinking of now was a boat ride. It went up and down the coastal canal of Florida, and we had a nice meal, etc. And there were some Russians, new physicists. They were actually doing work. One was graduating and just getting a PhD, but there was one woman, a young lady, very intelligent, hardworking young physicist from Russia, and she spoke broken English, but did speak English. So I talked to her on the deck of the boat. We're standing there talking. This particular area of study was in using the magnetic cycles and the magnetic study of the sun to predict solar cycles. And so it's actually an area that I work in. Part of my work deals with that. And they were working on particular computer models. And so this was interesting. She introduced herself, and I introduced myself to her. And she said, "Yes, I know who you are. I studied your work in high school, in university, and in graduate school in Russia." And so she had learned my work in Russian in Russia as a young girl. But that isn't taught today. It was stopped, and what I'm saying is around, the mid-90s is when it started, and it was like a wave that moved through Russia to prevent my work from being taught there. But it was interesting to actually talk to someone who had learned my work in Russia, in the Russian language, as a high school student, then in college, and then in university level. And the way that happened is in the mid-90s, the Russian scientists got a hold of my work, translated it, had dialogue with me, and clarified a lot of points, and then started teaching it in atmospheric science and space science, etc. But then at a point, NASA went in there and said, "Look, we'll give you this money, we'll give you support, but you got to teach this dirty snowball, you know, dark matter, the Big Bang, that kind of stuff. And if you kowtow to this program, you get to use our good equipment and stuff." And so anyway, that's what happened. So slowly my work got phased out of being taught in Russia. But that was very interesting. But the point was that the Russian scientists now, or I should say news release agency, because it's just like in the U.S. right now, the Russian scientists don't have a voice. They cannot go to the news media and have a news release. They have to go through the official news release agency. And, of course, that's controlled by the West. And the whole issue here is that it's just like banking. If you understand, the Rothschilds control the banks in Russia and the oil. They control the banks in the United States. And so there's an intricate balance of power going on here. That they control both sides, and I'm going into a little bit of a side note here so you understand how the world works. I heard a very interesting lecture one time, and the guy was explaining, he said he started out wondering, how could the bankers control whole countries? Because the countries have military, they have nuclear bombs. How can this joker over there in the European bank control these countries? Well, first of all, they have the CIA in the U.S., they have the Secret Service in Russia, they have the agencies that monitor what's going on, and so they control the politics, who's in office, etc. And here's how they control it: by controlling the technological, the engineering, the warfare machinery, and make sure there's a balance of power on both sides. So that if the U.S. gets a little bit out of line, the Russians, they can fund the Russians, and the Russians can come in and bomb the U.S. out of existence, or vice versa. If the Russians got a bit out of line, the U.S. could come in. And so it's very important for both sides to have the same phony science story. So at any rate, this latest article came out of Russia dealing with the comet. And now note that this is very interesting, and I don't have time to scour the internet and look at all these little nuances, so it's really great to see my fans out there pulling these little nuggets out and sending them in to me, but that the comet Elenin was discovered by the same search telescope facility in Russia as comet C2012S1, the comet I've been talking about that's coming into the solar system now. If you ever were going to have a comet that you wanted to blow up and tell all of the things that are going to happen with this comet, it would be the current comet, C2012S1. But they took comet Elenin, which was a nothing comet, a comet that would not cause anything, and blew it all over the internet. It was going to cause, they were going to end the world a dozen times over. All kinds of things were going to happen. They used my name. They had web pages dedicated to claiming that Jim McCanny claims this and that regarding comet Elenin. And I had to spend, a couple years of my show dealing with the fact that comet Elenin was a nothing comet. But the same outfit in Russia that discovered comet Elenin also discovered comet C2012S1. And I announced that last week. It's very interesting that they did not put the two discoverers' name, unlike comet Elenin was named after the professional astronomer from that observatory that discovered that comet. But it's in an automated search. But these guys have to examine the data, and when they examine the data that comes in from the automated search and they discover a comet, then they get their name on it. But oddly enough, the C2012S1 comet did not have this discoverer's name attached to it, which told me, as I announced last week, that they had been watching this baby come in for a long time. But there's a absolute effort across the board to minimize the announcements of C2012S1. And this would be the comet of any comet where they should have their little puppet subservient little websites out there jumping up and down and screaming and getting on radio shows and making all kinds of ridiculous claims and referencing me, but they're all quiet as a church mouse. Which is, it's really comical. It's almost, it's funny. But anyway, I'm going to search and see if I can find this Russian article. Yeah, I'm sorry, I've misplaced here on my computer that article. But basically, it couldn't say enough times, small icy wanderer, little poofy snowball, etc. So yeah, the Russians are in on that side of it also. Okay, here's a new security update for computer users, which is just about all of us. This came in from a listener, Larry. Thank you for sending this in. It says, I just became informed that there's a newly discovered security problem with computers which use a router. And so in your home, many people have a router. It's a wireless device. Your internet comes in on a cable. It plugs in from various types of connectors, but it plugs into a little box, and that's your internet connection. Or you might have a Wi-Fi connection, a radio connection, and that plugs into a router. But it's basically a little radio in your house that transmits to your computer. And there's a security code on it, which allows only you and the people in your house, the people allowed users, to use that router. The neighbors can see that router on their list of available Wi-Fi routers up and down the street. You see all your neighbors' routers on your list of Wi-Fi hotspots that you could log into, but most of them are secure because they have a password and you cannot. But, okay, so anyway, to continue, it says, in short, there is a newly discovered backdoor in the software that is used in most routers that allows hackers to gain complete control of your computer and entire network with administrative privileges. That means they can get into your router, control it, and then manage your router, even though you think you have administrative privileges. Okay, it says, I learned about this potential threat today on a local computer tech program on KFI 640 AM out of Los Angeles. A special web page has been set up which automatically tests your systems to see if it has this bug, and if it does, offer steps for you to minimize or eliminate the threat. As a note, many people who did not add a router to their system still could be at risk due to the fact that many DSL modems have a router which is built into them, so it is wise for everyone to test their system just to be safe. So even though you may not use Wi-Fi, even though you may just plug directly into your DSL modem, you still may have this problem. And then it says there is a web URL to look at this, and you can test your system. And so it's called the Universal Plug-and-Play Internet Exposure Test. And I'll read this off, but you could Google this, or let me see. No, don't Google it. Go to your favorite non-Google search engine and look this up, but it's upnp-rejected.htm. But look this up. I'm sure you can ask around. I'm not super techy. I've designed computers. I've done a lot of work with computer software and hardware, but a lot of this is very specialized. But anyway, just be aware that if you have a Wi-Fi router in your house, you could have invasion problems basically because of the way the software is built. And so this brings us up to a topic that happened many years ago. It was 6, 8, 10 years ago. The U.S. government went after a guy named Billy Gates. Billy was, the richest man in the world at the time. So not exactly a small fry financially or in terms of success. Bill had his business up in Seattle where they ran Microsoft. And he was not going to allow backdoors into some of the operating system software or some of the software that they were building there. The government has a deal. Anybody who develops software has to have a hook for the government to get into your computer, into the software, and just look around is the idea, because it's the government. Billy wasn't going to play ball. And so anyway, they made life real difficult for little Billy for a while. They were going to go after him. And I don't know if you remember the Heaven's Gates people. A lot of people don't understand that they were building software, encryption software. They were building the firewalls that the government could not get into, and we all know what happened with them. But at any rate, that's a whole different, very bizarre story. But back to Billy. Billy caved. Somebody must have came knocking on his door, sat down, had a little chat with him. And so Billy now is a member of the international elite. And as a result, gets to fly around, hobnob with all the biggest people, gets to donate to international water projects, all kinds of things, but all New World Order type of things. So Billy caved, now has the good life, and even got to buy into his own giant professional telescope facility down in South America. So that's what you get when you play ball with the big guys. When you don't, well, you're probably going to be pushing up daisies. So at any rate, this new security threat. And last week I announced that Google went around and did the Google, on Google Map, you can Google into your house and you can see the picture view of your house and everybody up and down the street and every place in town. To do this, they drove around with cameras on the automobiles, very high-tech cameras, and I announced at the same time they had monitoring equipment in those vehicles, and I've seen them. They had cameras mounted all over top, bottom, side, all around those vehicles, and they were, you can imagine the amount of expense that they had to go to photograph on high definition video the entire United States, all the streets, all the byways, all the routes. And so they recorded the Wi-Fi data from all of the Wi-Fi routers all around the country. And so this is just incredible, the amount of snooping that goes on going through people's routers. And so I would be safe to say, too, that probably all new TVs, remember when they required everybody to convert over to high-definition television, and if you didn't, you had to buy a special box that went on your old TV. You better believe there was monitoring equipment in all of that electronics to monitor everybody, everything you say, everything you do. I've always thought, too, all of the newest monitoring equipment, newest computer equipment, all has hooks in it for monitoring and transmitting that information back to the gov. Here's an article that someone referenced, sent in, a listener, and I found it was very interesting. The here's a great example of a Tier 2 dog and pony show. This time, not between internet quacks, but between Tier 2 scientists, one group versus the other, and it seems like a big controversy in science. And then, of course, it gets, but basically what they do is create a bogus theory, and then the other side comes in and refutes it. This case, one group creates a theory that comet attacks, and they're talking about dirty snowball comets, attacked the Earth and caused the end of the 9,000-year-old Clovis culture. And so the Clovis culture, they created a particular type of flint point for arrows and spears, and they're putting a date on the end of this around 9,000 BC. Well, of course, the Clovis culture had to be more recent than that because they were killing mastodons, and the mastodons died out about 4,000 years ago. Which is very well recognized in the what you might call the industry. But anyway, I'll just read this. This is from January 30th. It says, study rebutes hypothesis that comet attacks ended the 9,000-year-old Clovis culture. And so you understand they come in, say that one group comes in of Tier 2, one group of Tier 2 scientists comes in, says the Clovis culture ended because ice ball comets hit Earth and caused the end of the culture. And then the other group comes in and says, well, there's no craters to indicate that, and so it couldn't happen. Your theory is wrong. So comets could not have ended the Clovis culture. You see how the equation works here. Of course, they don't talk about action at a distance, my concept. They don't talk about what a comet really is, of course. It's all phony science. It's all garbage Tier 2 science. But this is what gets published in Science News. It's in the sciencedaily.com. If you want to look this up, Science Daily on the internet, sciencedaily.com, January 30th. But it says, rebutting a speculative hypothesis that comet explosions changed Earth's climate sufficient to end the Clovis culture in North America around 13,000 years ago. Sandia lead author Mark Bosloff and researchers from 14 academic institutions assert that other explanations must be found for the apparent disappearance. There's no plausible mechanism to get airbursts over an entire continent. Okay, so let's stop right there. So 14 academic institutions are against this concept that a comet or comets, comet explosions could have ended the Clovis culture. Well, clearly, there's no evidence for a bunch of comets coming in and basically attacking Earth. And so they're looking for a mechanism here for airbursts over an entire continent. But if you look at what comets really are and the fact that they can be big and come by Earth and act at a distance, then the issue is that they're presenting a phony theory, and it can't explain the hypothesis because the dirty snowball model doesn't work for anything. So then the other 14 academic institutions come in and prove that comets could not have done this. So it's just a little dog and pony show. It's worth mentioning because this is the kind of garbage that comes out. And it sounds real official. Let me read some of the official statements here that come from this group. So in December 2012, American Geophysical Union monograph, first available in January, the researchers point out that no apparent appropriately sized impact craters from that time period have been discovered, nor have any unambiguously shocked materials been found. In addition, proposed fragmentation and explosion mechanisms do not conserve energy or momentum, a basic law of physics that must be satisfied for impact cause climate change. So they're trying to say that comets, the initial group, was trying to say that climate change because of comet impacts. Ice ball comets, that is. But here, once again, they are presenting a bogus theory. The other 14 institutions come in, pick it apart, which is easy to do, proving that comets could not possibly have caused this. Anyway, it's worth noting, this is the way Tier 2 science works. It's the way Tier 2 science destroys correct information. And just as an aside note there, we know that many times over the past 10,000 years, the Earth has been affected, sometimes more, sometimes less, by major comet interactions. So at any rate, that's the real story. The bogus tier two story is what you're going to hear on these standard mouthpieces, Science Daily, Science News, the standard government mouthpieces. I've got a couple stories here. I might as well go into those right now, coming out of spaceweather.com. And once again, spaceweather.com, I've reported this many times, they continue with the bogus reporting of auroras, aurora borealis, the northern lights. And the whole issue here is that we have had an extremely an unpronounced low solar cycle. The solar cycle that we're currently in is supposed to peak, they say, in 2013. I don't see anything peaking back in 2000 before the peak of the last solar cycle. The sun was exploding daily with booming, boom, 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 hourly, almost hourly, major explosions. And sunspot activity, it was really peaking. In fact, it had a double peak. We don't have anything at all like that now. There are B and C class flares, the kind of things that ho-hum happen every day, no big deal. But there's nothing X class, there's nothing M class. None of the big flare activity is going on at all. So anyway, what they're trying to do is make a story where there isn't any. They're talking about the auroras. They're showing pictures from up around the Arctic Circle where the auroras occur every day. That's not a big deal, but they're trying to make it into a big deal. And here's the part I wanted to mention, because I don't want to just dwell on that bogus reporting from spaceweather.com on auroras, but here was the article that appeared today. It says that the United Nations is planning for bracing for 2013, kind of end of the world scenario for space weather, indicating that space, and of course the first thing you talk about in a solar flare is the grid, the electric grid coming down. And so why is the UN getting involved when we're in one of the weakest solar cycles ever? So what is the United Nations doing preparing for a imminent, as they are making it sound, solar space conditions? I mean, the UN's been around for many, many solar cycles. They never prepared for it last time or the time before. What's so special about this time? Well, gee, it looks like the New World Order is coming in possibly looking for an excuse on a worldwide basis. And what I've said before, and I have predicted, and people have tried to use me to indicate that, gee, the end of the world could come with a solar flare, and it can. There can be major solar flare issues. But this solar cycle is not the one I would call if we were talking about imminent solar flare damage to Earth, especially the solar grid. The historical record does not warrant it. You can always say there could be a volcano, there could be an earthquake, there could be this, there could be a flood, there could be a tsunami, it could rain, we could have, on and on. You could make predictions about anything, but of all of them, the least likely thing to cause a destruction of Earth right now in terms of historical records, in terms of historical accountability, is the solar cycle. We are in the weakest solar cycle that I know of in history. And this is something that I study. It's one of my topics that I work on. We are in a definitively minimal solar cycle. So at any rate, but the point is, what is the United Nations now doing in the preparedness mode for solar cycles? And I've always said you could bomb an area with conventional bombings. You could put in, say, biowarfare. That's a good example. You could inundate an area with weather control. One of the most effective ways to control large areas is with weather control. But the one sure way to shut everybody down and shut off everybody's life down to the last ant is to shut down the power grid. And so what I've said is there's going to be a false flag event. There's going to be some flare that comes towards Earth a little bit bigger than normal, and they're going to pull the plug, and that's when the curtain's going to fall. So anyway, that's very interesting. Spaceweather.com not only providing this phony aurora information, trying to hype up something that's not there as far as the auroras and that type of thing, and every little poof of the sun is like they talk about it as like the biggest flare on record, and then come out today and announce that the UN is on the warpath and somehow ready to respond on a worldwide basis to potential solar flaring and damage. And so at any rate, I just want to let you know, I think that this is in the works. It's on the way. You're going to see it in your lifetime. If you live for the next year, you're going to see the power grid go down. And one of my first comments was that when I started noticing this and noticing the announcements and all the NASA brouhaha over solar flaring and taking down the power grid, was, and especially when it was not warranted, was that it would be mainly in the United States. And the way to tell would be that the United States would go down, but all of the adjoining countries would be up and fine and running. So that wouldn't be due to a solar flare. So now the UN is involved, and so they can coordinate this on a worldwide scale. Isn't that swell? I just want to mention, as I did last week, all five of my books. The Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colvin Connection, the weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, and the Diamond Principle, all now available in ebook. And you can buy the entire set for $60. It's a great deal, so go to the webpage jmccsci.com and get your copies. Even if you have the hard copy, it'd be nice to carry around that e-copy to show to friends, to read when you're on a plane or on a bus or sitting at an airport or you're whatever you're doing and you have a few minutes. And these are the kind of books you can pick up and read. Just open up to a certain page or chapter and start reading. read them over and over again. And so that's the e-books are a great way to carry them around. The books in print are still available, will still be available in the future, but the point is that they're available in ebook format, and you can also, if you have not purchased the books yet, by the way, just a quick reminder, the Calculate Primes book with 3-hour DVD lecture will only be offered in print form in the future. Two reasons. It's a very complicated text, and it does not translate in terms of the terminology. It just doesn't translate and all the equations, etc. By the way, it's written for the public, but the technical part just does not translate. Also, the DVD is it just can't be transmitted electronically. It's a full 3-hour DVD. And so, at any rate, the Calculate Primes book will not be available in ebook format. But the other five, the five that deal with space science and outer space, are available electronically. And this will also prepare you for the new releases that are coming out. And so you'll understand the shows, the information. So anyway, enough of that. Okay, I wasn't going to do this, but it's so outrageously ridiculous that I have to. I just pulled up CNN today as part of my pre-show search just to see what kind of garbage is out there being promoted on the Internet. And here are the headlines. These are the headlines from CNN. I called it the Candy Nugget News. It says, "Our favorite wedding proposals. Mystery of missing World War II love letters. Why falling in love online is possible." Here's one. Drivers get stoned. Test road skills. Here's one. The best Jeopardy question ever. Here's one. A girl banned from class over red hair. This is the headline of CNN. It is complete and utter garbage. I can't believe, it's just incredible. Anyway, I don't want to spend any time on that. But with all of the issues, the important issues going on in the world today, that's what's being reported as major news around the country. Just a quick story on the solid waste. We all think of green energy, that word green. It just makes us feel good, like something good is going on. And a long time ago, I predicted it would be used for everything on the planet. People are selling routers, they're selling computer equipment, high-end computer equipment, all kinds of products across the board, from cleaning equipment to products, etc., using the word green. But when we think of solar panels and wind power, we're supposed to really think about green. But here is, I did a reporting last fall on the residue, the pollution residue from the wind industry, especially the magnets. The rare earth magnets that are used in wind generation, the material for that comes from powder that is mined in China. And the amount of material that they dig up from the earth and then have to sift through and then discard at the factories in China has literally poisoned and destroyed vast areas of China. And so at any rate, here's a report on the solar industry. It says this is in California, where much of the solar panel industry resides, where the solar panels are manufactured. It's and they are exporting the waste. It says more than 46 million pounds of waste was generated from solar companies in California between 2007 and 2011. 97% of the waste remained in California. Almost 1.4 million pounds of hazardous material was shipped to other sites across the country. And so at any rate, it talks about this the pollution that results from solar panel manufacturing. And here's an article that I felt I should read also, that Evergreen Aviation admits to chemtrail contracts with the U.S. Air Force. Okay, so Evergreen Air is, this is by the way, I'm reading from a report. This is posted by Brian Andrews, Chemtrail News, featured Tuesday, January 25th, in 2011. It says Evergreen Air is a CIA front company for chemtrail operations within the U.S., based out of Marina Air Park in Tucson, Arizona, and McMinnville, Oregon, near Portland. Let's see. Said it's a source, ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.com. Okay. Says Evergreen Aviation, one of the world's largest private aviation companies, admits to weather modification service. On their own website, in the market section of their new supertanker, they state weather modification among other interesting services marketed. So there you have it. A CIA front company admitting that they, in fact, do weather modification flying. They do the flights. And who's paying for this? This is so bizarre, this whole chemtrail thing. I've been involved in this back since the first days of the whole chemtrail issue. But it is so bizarre to have companies out there working for the CIA who do weather modification and dumping of chemicals into the atmosphere to do bizarre things. It just that in itself is bizarre. And here's the story. It says that a PowerPoint presentation from NASA confirms what people have been warning about for the decade or more. What is troubling is how NASA, a reported public space agency, is involved in all this black stuff, meaning black ops. Page 44 of a PowerPoint presentation by NASA, a mechanical analog to bio, micron-sized mechanized dust, which is distributed as an aerosol and inhaled into the lungs. The dust from this mechanically bores into lung tissue and executes various pathological missions. Listen to this. This sounds the various pathological missions, creating an entirely new class of weapons. This is just bizarre. Powders that are distributed and then people inhale them. That as they say, listen to this terminology, the dust mechanically bores into the lung tissue and executes various pathological missions. Wow, that is just strange. A new work by NASA. And just one other quick note here. On this past week, the largest prime number to date found by computers was announced, having 17 million digits. Now, this might sound impressive to some people. A number of years ago, there was a prime number discovered with 12 million digits. These are computer search programs, algorithms that find prime numbers. And basically, this is rather almost comical. When my book, a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago now, the Calculate Primes book came out, showing how to directly calculate prime numbers. And so what my fans did immediately was write into these computerized search agencies and universities, the people in charge of these, saying, look, there's a new way to get prime numbers. And you can do this much simpler. And so there were agencies that were out there giving prizes to the largest prime number found by computing, massive computer searches. And these would use the computers of many people out there to do combined calculations, put them together, and over time potentially find a new prime number. But the problem is that it doesn't give any understanding. Okay, you found another prime number. It sounds pretty big, 17 million digits. Well, to me, it's not a big number. When you're talking about infinity, I took a course when I was doing my double major physics mathematics. I took a course by with the book. It was a very small book by and the author of the book, George Cantor. He did his life work. One of his great contributions was on the infinities that are out there. What are the different infinities and what are they like? And so let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we can count up to any number by counting, and you can, and that goes to infinity. Okay, well, between all those numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, are real numbers. Or you could start with the rational numbers, just fractions, 1/5, 7/9, 27/57, all of the fractions that are out there, and that's a much larger group of numbers. So is the infinity of rational numbers bigger than the infinity of countable numbers, of like the integers? And now let's take the real numbers, the 1.5347 with many digits following. There's an even bigger number of those numbers, but they, and there's an infinite number of those. And so the question is there various levels of infinity? Are there infinities that are bigger than other infinities? And George Cantor did tremendous work and clarified this. It was one of my college courses dealing with the infinities of numbers. So at any rate, there are many types of infinity out there, but a number with 17 million digits is not infinite. And so they try and make this sound like this is such a big number, and it's really not. It's not that big a number when you look at things like the hydrogen atoms in our galaxy, the number of hydrogen atoms in our galaxy, vast, enormous numbers that would boggle the mind. And so we are not anywhere near the ability with computers to calculate truly big prime numbers. And the point is that even if you do calculate a number that's big, it doesn't tell you anything about where the next one will be, where the previous one was relative to that, or any pattern in the prime numbers. And that was what was so important about my prime number work when it came out, was to clarify the patterns of prime numbers. But what's comical is these computing agencies in their rules added a rule that you had to find the prime numbers with their computing algorithms. In other words, they had to be found in computer algorithms. that you couldn't use. Basically, they outlawed my work from being used to generate prime numbers, is the point. So at any rate, I just wanted to mention that the latest big prime number coming out was 17 million digits. But see, they can't tell you if there's any other ones between the 12 million digit number that occurred in 2009, I believe that was discovered, and now that's 4 years ago. So it took them 4 years of supercomputing time using many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of personal computers around the world networked together to discover one new prime number, but they can't tell you if there were any other prime numbers between the new one found and the old one. See what I mean? No understanding at all. So anyway, another ho-hum announcement, but it's very important to keep the image of prime numbers alive, because they're still used in many places because they're locked into hardware, firmware, software as encryption. The RSA codes, etc., are locked into all kinds of military hardware applications, because in the military you don't have changeable hardware. You have things that are set, they're locked in, and they're going to be there forever until that product, a jet, a tank, or whatever it is, a ship, until that product goes offline, that hardware is going to be there functioning and working. They can't have stuff that willy-nilly changes here and there. So all of this RSA code is locked into that equipment. But anyway, just wanted to make a comment on that, that a number with 17 million digits compared to infinity is not a big number. Sorry, no cigar here. By the way, I found it interesting, too, that the prize in 2009 that was given away for the 12 million digit prime number was $100,000. The prize that right now given to the guy who is the head of this project was only $3,000. So and they're talking about the first person to discover a prime number with 100 million digits will get a prize, but they didn't say, they were very cautious not to say how much. But once again, they go in and verify that you actually used a computer to calculate it. They're not going to let anybody use my method of calculating prime numbers and actually get a solution and win a prize doing it. They blocked that out. Like I say, they went in and changed the rules, which disallow my method of calculating primes directly from being used to win any of those prime number prizes. Okay, on with the final science topic here, how comet tails form. And here is the basics. You have a non-uniform plasma capacitor in outer space. This is formed by a non-uniform distribution of positive charge in the solar wind, and that sounds like pretty complicated deal. But basically, the solar wind creates a battery in space. It's a space battery with the positive side outwards, and it's like you took a little battery that you use in your flashlight, and one end it's marked positive, one side is marked negative. It's the same way in outer space, except it's not in a solid form. It's in a plasma, in a free plasma gas form, with the sun at the center. That's the negative pole, and out beyond the orbit of Pluto is the positive pole that's in the form of a giant, basically donut, that sits out there, and that's held back by the solar wind pressure. So at any rate, you have a battery. Now, the example I always use is the backyard bug killer. When a bug flies in between the grids, it discharges that local capacitor, zap, that goes out, kills the bug, and but the discharge always occurs where the bug is. And so that's a very important point, because when an object, a solid rocky object, comes into the solar system, discharges the solar capacitor, that discharge always will pass through where the solid objects are. The Earth, the Moon, Venus, Mercury, Jupiter, Saturn, the moons of Saturn, the moons of Jupiter. All of these, including the minor asteroids, the minor planets, the little dust particles out there, everything in this field is discharging the solar capacitor. And so as a comet comes in, cutting in askew at an angle, at a deep angle, to the capacitor, it's just like the bug coming in. And I always use this example also. If you could put the bug in there and have him hover and then turn on the electric field, the backyard bug killer, the bug would not be zapped because he's already in there. He has to fly in and drag that ground potential in with him. That's when he will discharge the little capacitor. And it's the same with the planets, etc. The planets like Earth that are already in circular orbits or near circular orbits around the sun are not going to discharge that capacitor very much at all. So at any rate, the comet does the comet nucleus. It could be small, it could be big, it could be size of Jupiter, it could be the size of a rock 10 feet across. It's going to discharge that solar capacitor. And so here's what happens. The electrons that are coming out from the sun are the bulk charge carriers. Why is that? because they have what is called the highest charge to mass ratio. For the amount of mass that they have the most charge. Their mass is small, their charge is large. A proton, for example, has about 1,900 times as much mass and only has a single positive charge. So it's a lot more massive. It's about 2,000 times more massive than an electron. So if you put a bunch of protons out there, positively charged, and a bunch of electrons out there, and they were left to migrate together, the bulk of the movement would be in the form of electron movement. The protons would pretty much sit where they are. The electrons would go to where the protons are. And so that's 99% where the movement would be with the electrons. So the point is that with the bulk of the electrons in the discharge, okay, they come out and they meet the comet nucleus. So what happens? Since the bulk of the charge carrier is in form of electrons negatively charged, they put a pressure, an electron pressure, on around the nucleus, and that region becomes electrically negatively charged, and it holds that charge. The bigger the discharge, the more charge buildup. Okay, so now you have a negatively charged object in outer space. What happens? Now the slower items. So the negative charge builds up around the nucleus. It attracts the positively charged ions, protons, etc., to come into that region. Once they start coming into the region, they build up energy, and as they come in, there's enough energy of movement, of formation, and the electric fields where, just say, oxygen and hydrogen, it's pulling in. It's like a big vacuum cleaner. It's like an electric vacuum cleaner in outer space. It pulls in the atoms, the raw atoms, from a great distance. And as they come together, they start to combine to form water, ammonia, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, ammonia, all of the various compounds. They can form up to the nucleotides of DNA have been found in comet tails. The hydrocarbons, all of the chemicals, it's just a complete chemical mixing bowl in outer space. Once these chemicals get in around the nucleus, now there's another factor that kicks in. If there's enough gravity, then the comet nucleus will start to attract this and start building up mass. So at any rate, I'll continue with this topic next week. But remember to go to the webpage, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com, JMCCSCI.com. And remember that the five books dealing with space science are in ebook format right now, all five available. You can buy them individually, all five available for $60. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.